shoo-ba, let me in.
Shoo-ba, shoo-ba,
I want to be closer to you.
Shoo-ba, shoo-ba,
open up your soul.
Shoo-ba, shoo-ba,
let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. My first guest is someone that I have wanted to interview for literally ages. I've been hearing about her for decades and I could never, ever get it together. Then yesterday, I was out having my mind touched, and who should I be seated next to but the legendary Rhodessa Jones. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on the show today. So, Rhodessa Jones, you are an institution here in San Francisco, but I want to go way back to before you were an institution, when you were a youngin, and find out how you first got into acting and, you know, performing in general. So when did it start?
Well, my mother and father were migrant workers.
Mm-hmm.
And we traveled we had a home in Florida. We would travel every year as far north as New Jersey, picking vegetables. And I didn't know until much later that my mom and dad had the dream of living in California.
Uh-huh.
And so California became this place to be. And I come from a family of storytellers.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother was an amazing storyteller. That's how she would guide us, teach us, discipline us was through storytelling. Everything from Grimm's fairy tales, which I found out much later,
mm-hmm.
to her own stories of growing up as a little girl and when she made mistakes. So back to your question, I think it's always been there in my blood.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea that you could mesmerize the world with stories, that people love stories. It was the way to talk to people. So I guess I'd say from the very beginning, I was a little girl who loved entrancing people with my own journey. Yeah.
Okay. So, being that you have this grandmother who tells you these amazing stories, did you in turn try to tell stories to other people as a little kid, or did that come much later?
No, I tried to tell stories. I mean, I tried. You know, like I said, we were migrant workers,
mm-hmm.
so we would travel to the north from Florida, and just part of being seen and taking up space was to act out, to not in a bad way, but
mm-hmm.
just to be a focus point for people.
Okay.
So I guess it started when I was 4 or 5 years old. Yeah.
Okay. And my experience of very young children trying to tell stories is that they're not very good, but because they're super young and cute, you listen to them. Do you recall ever being told that your stories were good when you were a little kid?
No, but I had a teacher, an elderly white woman,
mm-hmm.
who used to get so upset because the kids would be entranced. And she would sit me outside because she felt like I was being disruptive.
Mm.
So I think that says something about what I was doing was on the right track. Yeah.
Okay. So then.
Yeah. And, you know, just telling stories about how my mother and father grew vegetables, how my dad had been such a fighter in his young age. And also, I wasn't to be messed with, but none of us were. I come from a family of 12 children.
Wow. That's a lot.
My mother had 19 pregnancies and 12 of us lived.
Wow.
So 8 brothers and 4 sisters. Yeah. So, and we had to fight for our place in line,
yeah.
You know? And all of that became a part of the energy that I brought to the world. Yeah.
So in this family of 12, were you considered the storyteller? Because, you know, everybody gets assigned a role when you have that many kids.
No, I was the 8th kid. All of us were pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
My father used to really believe, don't let the truth stand in the way of a good story. So, you know, sometimes sitting at the dinner table, he expected us to share.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, and I miss my dad. So my dad died. My father died the night of the day that Ronald Reagan was shot.
Oh.
My father died. And he was a great guy. My father was a wonderful guy. Yeah, he saved my mother some heartache. Because when he saw my mother, he fell in love with her children. And he said to my older brothers and sisters, he said, you all are going to go to school. You're not going to work in the term time quarters. You're going to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that stole my mother's heart away. Yeah.
So, well, that brings up a question. As migrant workers who are traveling, how were you able to stay educated? Was there someone teaching you, or did you have times when you were in one place long enough to go to school?
Oh, we went to school. My mother and father traveled with a group of people who picked the vegetables, but my mother was very adamant that we went to school, so we had the experiences of a lot of different schools, but no, we went to school wherever we were.
Okay, okay. So,
yeah.
Did you ever, I know people who travel, like military kids, when they are often the new person every time and they never get to feel rooted. So did you get to ever feel rooted?
Well, yes and no. My mother and father finally bought a house, a farm house in upstate New York, mm-hmm. and we were settled there, and we went to an elementary school in Wayland, New York.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, we were a part of this community. There were not that many black people, but my mother would dress us well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would, and she would tell us to don't act common. You know,
uh-huh.
At the same time, don't let people get in your face and tell you who you are. You tell them who you are.
Mm, okay.
And I remember that kind of stuff. Oh, my mother was something else. My mother used to say, be a woman, don't be no dress. Say what you mean and mean what you say. This is when I was, when I was a budding teenager.
Mm-hmm.
I had a kid at 16.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember my mom was desperate that she shared with us whatever she thought the rules of life were.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What were the rules of life that she shared with you that you hang on to this day besides the, you know, be a woman and don't let people get in your face?
Well, you know, say what you mean and mean what you say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and try to keep it friendly, you know,
sure.
And that nobody is better than anybody,
mm-hmm.
which brings me to my work, my work with incarcerated women, with incarcerated people. You know, they were always fascinating to me because I had a brother who was at Attica. A brother who was at Attica for a very long time.
Okay.
But my mother's rule of, I think she was also saying, be respectful.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're all here on this journey together, you know, and just know that everybody has a story. Everybody comes from somewhere with their own version of the world.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. So when did it go from being someone who's a storyteller just to have their place in a great, you know, in a big group of children to doing that in front of an audience?
Oh, I was a hippie chick,
okay.
You know, when I finally left my mother and father's house, I left with a very fine man, an Irishman, mm-hmm. and we started to travel. We lived in Costa Rica, you know, and then we came to California. And I guess to answer your question, I started to, I took on my family's children's theater company, and I started teaching the children how to tell stories, but I wanted them to be more politically invested than we were. So I remember when Stephen Biko died in South Africa,
uh-huh.
and telling my nieces and my nephews and their friends that I wanted them to go home and listen to the news, and then we'd meet on Saturday mornings, and they'd have to tell us what had affected them. Mm. And to answer your question, I was probably 20 years old around now.
Okay.
And I started to encourage the children to tell their stories. And then I joined a theater company myself. I worked with a company entitled Tumbleweed.
Uh-huh.
Tumbleweed was a women's dance company. And I found, again, that people were entranced. When I opened my mouth, they'd want to listen. We're talking about the late 60s, early 70s.
Okay.
And people would listen to my stories. And also, I wanted to find my own place in this group. And I knew I was black. I was the only black person in the group. And I wanted to make sure that people understood that I understood how the world functioned on a certain level. So I guess that's when the storytelling started to blossom into a profession of sorts, yeah.
Okay. So when you're first telling those stories, are they off the cuff or are you writing them down?
Well, they're off the cuff. They're taken from the news.
Okay.
They're taken from the news being that, you know, I was a child of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so, mm-hmm. And I was with a group of women. And I was the one who had a baby,
mm-hmm.
and I would, you know, so a mixture of the two. I started to write things down because as time went on, the California Arts Council reached out to me and asked me would I be interested in teaching aerobics in the city jail.
Wow.
And there I started to bring the stories that I had shared as a woman trying to raise a baby,
mm-hmm.
and also trying to get women to talk about where we were in the world, who we were in juxtaposition to how the world functioned. So no, it was a mixture of the two. Yeah.
So how did you get on the radar for them to ask you to teach aerobics?
I was at the city jail in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
working. I had got hired to teach movement.
Oh, okay.
And I, but I got more famous for my storytelling.
Uh-huh.
And the deputies, they were just, you know, America, I love America, but we can be so far behind in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
But the deputies would listen to me talking to the women. I remember telling this young woman who wanted to have a beef with me. She wanted to argue with me,
mm-hmm.
a young woman who was in jail. And she said to me, she said, well, you know, you just one of them colored girls that went to school, but you ain't no better than me. And you think you're better than everybody else. And I think that she didn't know what to do with the fact that I had a strong voice. I treated them as much as I could as equals. So I said to her, I said, you know what? They pay me to be here, and I'm going to go home at noon. Now, what are you going to do? And the deputies were like enthralled. They were like, who is this person? You know, and they would get very quiet, and I'd say, and she would get, this girl would get so upset. I'd say, you know, the deputies can take you back to the dorm, honey, and there's nothing you can do about it. I said, so are we going to get along or not? And I saw something happen with this young woman that I carry with me now. It was like, wow, I have the choice. I can either work to be an ally with this woman, or I can fight and the deputies will take me back to the dorm. Yeah, and this was all a part of my education as an artist. So. Mm-hmm. And then I went to Mike Hennessy, who was the sheriff at this time, mm-hmm. and I thought I wanted to get the women to tell their stories. I wanted to find a way to sit in a circle and have women tell me their name, or tell me their grandmother's name, tell me what they thought they knew, what they had learned from their mothers, their sisters, and the world. Mm-hmm. And he was very open. He's very open to it, you know. And as time went on, I told him I'd like to take the women out of jail and put them on stages. And thus we ended up at Lorraine Hansberry. We ended up at Theater Artaud. You know, we ended up at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. Mm-hmm. But you know, I'm kind of rushing along, but all this stuff started to happen. Yes.
So when you have this idea to do to put women who are incarcerated on stage, and
yeah.
I maintain that the reason why young people do things is because they don't know just how much work or how hard it's going to be, which is why things actually happen, because you go into it really not knowing. So what were some of the things that you learned that allowed you to grow the next time you did the Theater for Incarcerated Women?
The shame, getting rid of the shame, you know, because women love to talk, you mm-hmm. know, we're very talkative. Mm-hmm. So even inside, before I went to the sheriff, I realized that the women like to share their stories, and some of them boast, and they talk, you know, and it's not always true. But that was also the shame of having to deal with addiction, with rape, with incest. And I would say to them, you know, somebody needs to hear your story. I say, you're not alone, you know. And the other women would get, they would perk up and look at me. I'd say, you know, come on, y'all. We all have been through something, you know. And even to this day with women, I still tell them, you know, what happened to you? I ask, what happened to you? Can we figure out a way to talk about how you arrived at this place, jail being the place?
Mm-hmm.
And I found that what they were grateful for was that I wasn't judging them. I truly wanted to know how did, because, I mean, in jail there's black and brown women largely.
Mm-hmm.
And I say to them, I say, I didn't end up in jail, so how was my life different than your life?
Right.
Or I would say to them, what can you tell me about staying out of jail? And they were kind of moved that I would expect them to know something.
Mm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. they were, and that's how I saw it happen. Their eyes would kind of light up. They go, oh, she expects us to step up and share what we know, where we've been.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such a plus for me. I love that. I love that.
So when you're working with these women and you're actually seeing them and asking them the question of how is it that I, you know, that what do I need to do to continue to stay out of jail? What were some of the things that you heard that maybe surprised you?
Well, they say, don't count on no man.
Mm.
They say, you know, most of them agreed that they're in jail because of love. Looking for love in all the wrong places. I say, mm-hmm. And they say, you know, and don't let him convince you to carry the bag. His bag, he carries it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I thought, whoa, that is so interesting. And I saw women find this information impromptu, and it surprised them that they knew enough that they could share with the quote teacher, you know.
Mm-hmm. So
and they would say, you know, trust your girlfriends more, trust mm-hmm. the women around you. And I think that surprised them that this came up to be an answer. And I'd agree with them. I'd say, yeah, it's my girlfriends that have kept me out of trouble, you know. And some women would say, well, they all don't keep you out of trouble. I said, of course not. I mm-hmm. said, there's always some girl your mother tells you not to hang around with. And we'd all laugh, you know.
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So So you do the Medea Project Theater for Incarcerated Women. Do you remember the first show that you did?
Yes.
Let's talk about
it. It was entitled Realities Just Outside the Window.
Okay.
And what? And I had met grandmothers, you know, when I was working in jail. Grandmothers would, I would do something in jail, and grandmothers were encouraged to come and hear me. Other deputies, other women inside, and the women started to say, well, can we do what you do, Miss Jones? I say, yeah, but it's a lot of work, and it's kind of scary because you got to tell the truth. I mm-hmm. said, you know, you can't get up here and just sell a bunch of malarkey to mm-hmm. people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But they were learning to listen. That was the thing that one of the things I feel like I've been blessed with is this ability to turn the light on,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And also women would cry, and I'd say, you know, we cry, and then we stop crying, and then what are we going to do, you know? Mm-hmm. And what about our children? And I'd get them to write letters home to their children. I tell you, I went to South Africa years later,
mm-hmm.
and I told the women in the South African prison, I said, you know, one of the first things, this is my first day there, and I said, one of the first things we're going to do is we're going to write home letters to our children, telling them where we are. We're going to tell them what we're doing, what happened. And one girl said, like Papa Mandela?
Mm.
And my heart flew away. I was like, yeah, like Papa Mandela. And then they proceeded to school me about Mandela's life in prison.
Mm.
But back to your question about the first time I worked with the women, they were so excited, and we had such a large house. We were at Theater Artaud in San Francisco,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and I said they could invite their families. They could invite their mothers, their children, to hear them. And I said, but you got to stand up straight, and you got to speak loudly, and you got to engage in the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I think your families deserve to know what's going on. I said, believe they love you. They're not going to judge you. And that was like, and all this stuff was coming from me, you know, kind of spontaneously. I was talking about what I felt I knew.
Mm-hmm.
But no, that was the first, and they wanted to know, like, how do I arrive at a title? And I said, just think about your lives is out there. Everybody is thinking about getting out of jail and then doing what?
Mm.
And but they kept writing, and they wanted to read, and they wrote poetry, they wrote prayers, they wrote songs, and I started to invite the women from the community,
mm-hmm.
the other artists. I invited them to come in and work with us. So the very first show was a wonderful mixture of social workers, actresses. And then soon, not the first show, but soon, we were allowed to bring in ex-offenders agreed to come back in.
Oh.
And that was pretty amazing, yeah.
That's what I was going to ask you is, did you have women who had done the Medea Project, who then got out of jail and stayed, you know, continue to tell stories and perform?
Well, I think that they were busy trying to be respectable.
Mm.
I would meet women on the street, and they'd introduce me to their fiancés.
Mm.
And the men are like, huh? You know? but they loved it that I remembered who they were. Some of them didn't want to talk to me because they didn't want to be associated with jail.
Right.
But a lot of them wanted to just let the life that they were living outside, they wanted me to see them being healthy, free of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there was always women that were struggling with drugs. But they wanted me to, they liked it that I recognized them on the street. And mm-hmm. I did not shy away from them.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, why did you choose the name The Medea Project? Why Medea?
Because of Greek mythology. You know the story of Medea?
I do, but some of our listeners may not.
Well, Jason, Jason and the Argonauts was a story. My brother and I went to the movie and saw this movie that was made, and I can't think of the actor who starred in it, but it was about Jason, who was an adventurer,
mm-hmm.
who traveled around, and Jason meets Medea. And they tell me that Medea was a Kurdish woman. I don't know this for fact. But Medea is told by her husband, Jason, mm-hmm. that he's going to take on a more prominent wife, a woman with political standing, and he wants her gone.
Mm.
And she's heartbroken. So she kills, they had two children, she kills the children in revenge. And then also she has her father and her brother killed as well, all in the name of love. And this is the story I started to share with the women inside. And this is what we do for love. And they were just amazed that, and they were all angry at Medea, and they called her the B word. And I said, wait a minute, how many of us are not with my mother's with my children, they'd say. I said, the children are not with you, honey. They're children waiting for you to come home. And that was how I began to share the Medea Project with women on the inside. And then I met a woman who was in jail, and her husband was taking care of the children because the woman couldn't stay out of jail.
Wow.
And I thought that was a flip on the whole myth, you know. And she eventually went out and did hard time, and the baby died, and the father was... And I got to know the dad a little bit before he disappeared into the ether. Yeah.
Mm. These stories, how do you separate the pain? Because you listen to it and you can't help but internalize some of it. So how do you keep from being brought down by the pain that these women are experiencing?
Oh, I feel the tears are so healing. I feel like we would all cry.
Mm-hmm.
We would just cry. And of course, you know, because I am an artist with an artistic community, I had massage. I had gym. I had to do all this stuff just to keep my own spirits up.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I recognized that it was hard, it was heavy. But then I would remind myself I wasn't in jail,
right.
You know, and that would give me a one-up. And so I remember being at the city jail, at the county jail,
mm-hmm.
And I saw, I had one of my first shows in the jail with the women, and they lost it because the audience was largely men.
Mm.
And they started to shake their butts and compete with each other. And it was a man who said, hey, y'all, your stories are important. Y'all can throw everything away for us.
Mm.
And I had to stop the whole performance and start again. And I remember, wow, thinking that because these men knew the women on the outside.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they say, come on, y'all, don't throw everything away. Look, we're all in jail here, they'd say to them.
Wow.
And so all of this stuff was coming at me, all of this information, and also this group of human beings who happened to be in lockdown.
Mm-hmm.
And they were sharing so much with me. Yeah. And it kept me strong in a lot of ways. For lack of a better term, I just stayed strong and was glad that I had this to do. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you just did a retrospective of your work. Can you tell our listening audience a little bit about that?
The San Francisco arts community awarded me a legacy award for my work for the last 40 to 50 years.
That's amazing.
And one of the things that I had written in my grant was that I wanted to do a performance. I wanted to do a performance to honor the San Francisco Arts Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I wanted this audience to see the latest group of women who were working with us, because we get, you know, us being the Madea Project. But so I planned a 2-day bit. It was entitled Just Outside of Babylon, There is a Rude Paradise. And the first evening was me being interviewed. I don't know if you're familiar with Joanna Haigood. Fabulous a mover, a woman. She can fly, Joanna Haigood. Mm-hmm. But Joanna Haigood interviewed me about my life as you and I are talking.
Mm-hmm.
Joanna and I did that the first Friday night. The audience, I think, they really appreciated and loved it. And then the second night, I performed with the Madea Project and my core group of artists. We performed doing new works and old works together on stage at Brava for Women in the Arts.
Okay.
It was fantastic. I was so proud of it. Yeah.
Oh, yay. Is there any way that people can see some of the work that you have done in the past?
Oh, I tell people, Google me. I'm very interesting. YouTube me.
Uh-huh.
I'm very interesting.
Okay.
And also, you know, they can reach out to the Madea Project.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have, you know, we have actual videos and things that we can share.
Okay. Okay.
And yeah. Rose Jones 09 at gmail.com. They can reach out to me and we'll see what we can do about getting them some footage. But I think if I'm correct, we got to be putting more stuff on our webpage.
Mm-hmm.
So to be available to people. Yes.
Okay. And then, you know, we spent most of the time talking about the Madea Project, but tell us a little bit about, in the few minutes we have remaining, about the performance company Cultural Odyssey.
Oh, Idris Akamore and I started a performance company, I guess, 30 years ago.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And It was wonderful. We were a couple at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And we also wrote plays with playwrights. We did a play entitled, I Think It's Gonna Work Out Fine, with Ed Bullins. And we took it all over the world. I think we even took it to Japan.
Wow.
And then we did one called The Love Project, mm-hmm. which was about love in all of its forms.
Mm-hmm.
But it was largely a two-person performance group, he and I. And we're not working together much now. He's doing his music,
mm-hmm.
and I am doing, I am planning on just doing some solo work, but I've been ill, so I'm not up and about as much as I should be. But no, the Madea Project, no, excuse me. The Cultural Odyssey is live and well in San Francisco, and Idris Akamore and Danny Glover did a wonderful evening entitled Artistic Being last year around this time. We mm-hmm. did a live performance with Danny speaking to music, me speaking, and Idris and the band. Look it up, though. Look up Cultural Odyssey. Look up the Madea Project, see different CrossFit women. We have a lot of stuff out there.
I'm going to look up all of those things. So for one more time for our listening audience, what is the website that you recommend they go to find out about you and what you're doing?
The Madea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women / the HIV Circle. Yes.
All right. Well, Rhodessa Jones, I'm thrilled to finally have a chance to interview you. It's been a huge pleasure and an honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
All right. People of Earth.
Oh, yes. Have a good day. Be
you
safe.
You too. You too.
Okay. All righty.
People of Earth, you got to hear the incandescent Rhodessa Jones. I'm so thrilled, all because I decided to touch my mind. There was someone there whose mind I'd want him to touch my mind for decades, and so I'm thrilled. And in just a little bit, we'll be speaking with Rotimi Agbabiaka about his new show called Godless. So do stay tuned. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco.
Your story, story, story. What's your crime? What got you here? Rage, lust, or fear? We all got a story, cause we're doing time. Ratata, 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 ratata. Tell your story. Ratata.
Okay, fine. Ratata. My boyfriend had meth in the glove compartment of our car, and I got pulled over for something else, and a cop found it.
Ooh! Well, did you dump that good-for-nothing drug-planting boyfriend?
No, we're still together. I love him.
Oh, well, did you at least tell the cops that it was his meth?
I mean, I could have turned him in, but my boyfriend and I have a son. I can't risk our child having both parents in jail.
It's true, that's a good. Story, story, let's hear another story. Story, story, that one was just sad. What does your story say about the patriarchy? We have all got stories cause we did bad. Ratata, ratata, ratata. Story go.
Okay, I stole a sweater from the mall.
Ooh, have you been stealing all your life? Was this the culmination of a lifetime of kleptomania, or were you doing it to stick it to the problematic fashion industry?
No, the heat went out of my apartment and I couldn't afford a sweater, so I stole one.
Oh, hey, I stole a sweater too. I got 2 months. How long are you in for?
3 years.
Story, story, these are barely stories. They're just bleak anecdotes with no start or end. Tell your story.
Okay, sure, I have a story. I'm in here for murder.
Oh, murder! Juicy! Ratata.
While I was driving, my daughter texted me that she was in the hospital, and I got so distracted that I hit a teenager who was crossing the street, and he died.
Story, story, oh my God, with that story. Story, story, take away her chair.
Okay, you know what? I'm just gonna share my story because you guys aren't really versed with a sense of story structure, so I'm gonna show you how it's done. I was a no-good, manipulative love addict with undiagnosed borderline personality disorder. I swindled. Drum. I cheated. Drum. I called out a hit on my ex-boyfriend's girlfriend. Drum, drum. Then, one day, this guy Trent came into my life. He was ironically just like me. And he tried to kill the man I loved, so I pushed him off a building. And then, when I pled guilty just for, like, metaphorical symbolism, the judge knew I was innocent, so she didn't accept my plea, but I wanted to go to jail anyway.
Wait, what?
You don't have to be here.
You chose to be here?
My skin is black, my arms are long, my hair is woolly. My back is strong, strong enough to take the pain inflicted again and again. What do they call me? My name is Aunt Sarah. Sarah, my skin is yellow, my hair is long, between two worlds. I do belong. My father was rich and white. He forced my mother late one night. What do they call me? My name is Sophronia. My name is Sophronia.
To 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. That's Nina Simone and Four Women. Didn't get the the denouement, but that is Four Women. Before that, we heard from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, What's Your Story? You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind right now? Why? Another person. The person whose mind, who was touching my mind when I got to meet Rodessa, because they're doing a brand new show called Godless. Without further ado, I'd like to welcome Rotimi Agbabiaka. Welcome.
Hello. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being on the show today. So, Rotimi, tell our listening audience a little bit about you. How long have you been performing?
I have been performing for professionally. I've been performing since I was born, a long, long time ago. But professionally, I've been performing about 16 years from when I first moved to San Francisco right out of acting school and joined the San Francisco Mime Troupe.
Oh, that's really cool. So you went to acting school. I've always wondered about that because I know that there are actors who go to school and then there are actors who've never been to acting school. And can you tell the difference?
I think good actors, I mean, I think it's a craft and skill. So everyone requires training. Mm-hmm. You don't have to get it at school, but you can tell when somebody has the training, I think, to use their voice, to use their imagination, to use their body effectively. Mm-hmm. And some get that through studying at school, and some get that, you know, through learning on the job or various other ways.
Do you think that actors who go to school, like they have more confidence? Because I know that people who, when they maybe didn't get a college degree, even though they're at the top of their field, they often feel a little bit insecure about their abilities.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's different for every person, but I think, you know, if you have training, you know, if you have a technique, a process, that helps you feel more confident. It's a tough business and one in which, you know, there are all kinds of factors mm-hmm. that determine, you know, success or whether you work or not. So I think everyone is still very, has a lot of confidence issues, you know, regardless of your amount of schooling. But I think it helps to have that skill and technique that you can count on, you know, to do the job.
Okay. Now, the last time I saw you in a production, you were playing Captain Hook in Peter Panto over there, which was delightful. I loved it because it's one of those roles where you have permission to just chew the scenery. So tell our listening audience a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Thank you. Yeah, as you said, you get to chew the scenery. And so I played Captain Hook in a version of Peter Pan, a version in a production that's called The Panto. And Panto is kind of a parody of fairy tales and music and big costumes.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to really have a lot of fun with the panto. We do it, you know, every holiday season at the Presidio Theater. And so I play Captain Hook, who was the villain.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so much fun playing the villain. You get to be bad. You get to chew the scenery. You usually get to wear the best costume.
Uh-huh.
And so it was a lot of fun, and the audiences loved it. It's a very family-friendly show, so we have audiences of young children
mm-hmm.
all the way through adults of all ages, and you know, there's a lot of audience participation. We throw candy out into the audience.
Mm-hmm,
it's just
mm-hmm.
a really great time, and I love, I've done the panto now for the past 5 years, or 6 years, and it's just, well, yeah, it's my favorite time. It's just such a good time on stage, and I from what I can tell from the way the audience responds, I think they're having a really good time too.
Oh yeah, I remember my favorite costume was the dress that looked like books. I was like, I would kill for
yeah.
to be able to wear that. That was my favorite costume. But I digress. We're here to talk about Godless. So, and that's a show that you put together. So talk a little bit about what was your inspiration for doing it, and what made you decide
yeah.
you wanted to put a show together. Because that's a lot of work.
Yeah, so so if you know the Presidio Theater, there's a large, beautiful, large theater space.
Mm-hmm.
But the Presidio Theater has been, Peggy Haas, who runs the theater, has always wanted to have an intimate space in the theater. And so they finally put together this beautiful 50 seats intimate venue and asked me to do something there to inaugurate the space. And
okay.
I've put together this cabaret show that is inspired by my fascination with mythology. I've always been, you know, since I was a child, fascinated by mythology and these stories of gods and heroes and goddesses and,
mm-hmm.
and all sorts of beings. And so Godless is a show where we fuse stories and characters from mythology, primarily Greek mythology, but we have some appearances from other mythological systems.
Mm-hmm.
And we fuse those stories with performances of pop music, show tunes, jazz standards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I have a band. I play a nymph who is a sort of a mythological creature
mm-hmm.
called Dion. And I have a band called Dion and the Nymphettes. And
mm-hmm.
so I'm joined by some amazing musicians. And we put together a fun, silly, and hopefully, I think, meaningful a collection of songs and stories inspired by mythology.
Well, let's give a shout out. Who makes up your band? Because I enjoyed them great deal.
Absolutely. So we have our maestro, multi-instrumentalist and musical director, Ben Jordvalkis,
mm-hmm.
On various instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have two wonderful singers, Zara Rothschild and mm-hmm. Pangea, and they make up the Nymphettes. They're really fantastic, and we have a really great time playing together.
And what was the process for deciding which songs you were going to cover and which mythologies you were going to weave them together with?
Yeah, great question. So I started out with the songs, since this is a cabaret show and the music is really the center of it. And at first I had a very long playlist of songs that seemed to reference mythology or religion,
mm-hmm.
you know, and as I you know, listened to the songs and lived with them for a bit, I worked with them, worked with Ben, my musical director, on them, and we found these fun arrangements, and then common threads began to appear, and really they began to really think about themes of ambition and what does it mean to be human versus, you know, a god,
mm-hmm.
right, and,
mm-hmm.
and what happens when human beings try to act like gods.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so as we were doing that, as I was reading various stories and just reflecting on the stories that I loved, I really began to feel this affinity for the story of Phaeton,
mm-hmm.
Who is a person who aspires to ride or drive the sun god's chariot. And I won't spoil the story for you, but it doesn't go very well.
Right.
And so that story became the central story in our piece. And we found a humorous, way to really tell that story and explore that story and the way that it resonates for many of us
mm-hmm.
Who have big dreams, big hopes, and also have to contend with the fact that we are ultimately, you know, human beings.
Right. And I'm not going to spoil it, but my thought when I was watching it was, what father just hands the keys over to the car? You go with your inexperienced kid in the car with them. But, you know, gods don't think the way we do. So whatever. Do you have a favorite mythological story that you aren't performing that you like to recount?
Oh, that's a great question. I love the story of Narcissus. That's another story that I've been thinking about and reflecting on many stories. And there's just a resonance to that story. Narcissus is a beautiful young man who is the longer version of the story, but ultimately he becomes so in love with his image. He's kind of cursed by the gods because he rejects a nymph and she asks for retribution. And so he gets cursed to only be in love with his own image.
Mm.
And so Narcissus wastes away. He like sees himself in a pool and he becomes so in love with his reflection that he just gazes at the reflection and he doesn't eat, he doesn't do anything, and he wastes away. Reading that story recently and just thinking, wow, what a metaphor for our times when we are so obsessed with looking at ourselves on Instagram and just how much we miss of life, you know, when we get consumed with our image, right?
With
obsessed with our image.
Right,
and
right,
so
right.
That's a story that's really been resonating with me recently, the story of Narcissus, from whom we get the word, you know, narcissist.
Right, right, right. So with Godless, like, I know you're doing it one more weekend. So tell our listening audience when and where and how to get tickets.
Yeah, so Godless is playing at the Presidio Theater. That is in the Presidio. It's on 99 Moraga Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's playing from this Thursday, July 16th, to Sunday, July 19th. The show times are 7:30 p.m., Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And then on Sunday, we have a matinee at 2 p.m. And you can get tickets if you go to the Presidio Theater's website.
Mm-hmm.
That is Presidio Theater. I think it's theater with an R-E. Yes, it is. PresidioTheater.org to get tickets to Godless.
Okay. And that's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, or?
Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Okay. And then after that, because you and I had a conversation, you said you were going to be working on another show that's coming up pretty quickly. So tell our listening audience about that.
Yeah, this is still a musical show, but a little different. I will be doing the stage direction for a performance, a concert performance of Carmina Burana, that wonderful piece by Carl Orff. Dun, 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 dun. You hear it in so many movie trailers.
Uh-huh.
I hear new music from it. There's a lot more to it than just that movement. But it's going to be performed by the San Francisco Choral Society at the Davies Symphony Hall on August 15th at 7 p.m. So I'm directing that. They'll also be doing a performance of Carmina Burana and a new commissioned work by Eric Tuan called Three Portraits, Voices of Chinese American Women from Early California. So it'll be a concert by a really wonderful, huge chorus of singers. And I'll be directing the movement with some dancers. It's going to really be a wonderful visual experience as well as musical experience. And so that's going to be happening August 15th at the Davies Symphony Hall.
Excellent, excellent. So we just have like a minute left. So if people want to find out more about what you're doing, about all the things you're doing, how do they go about doing that?
Yeah, they can visit my website, rotimionline.com. That is R-O-T-I-M-I, online, O-N-L-I-N-E, .com. So if you go to my website, you can the announcements, and you can also sign up for my email mailing list, which I send out occasionally with announcements about performances coming up.
All right. Well, Rotimi Agbabiaka, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, and I also want to say I really enjoyed your show yesterday.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thank you for being there yesterday. I'm so glad you enjoyed the show. Always a pleasure chatting with you.
All right. Okay, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out Rotimi's show, Godless, and, to get things on your calendar. I know I had to write physically a calendar so that I could look at it because it's just filling up with things to touch my mind. There's so many things in San Francisco that will touch your mind. So if you're choosing not to, that is a decision that you're making on your own. So here's the deal. Go out, get your mind touched, and enjoy what life has to offer. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.
The meanest dog you'll ever meet, he ain't the hound dog in the street. He bears some teeth and tears some skin, but brother, that's the worst of him. The dog you really gotta dread is the one that howls inside your head. It's him whose howling drives men mad and a mind to its undoing.
Wait for me, I'm coming.